This is a book, Women of the Way, about most of the women Zen teachers are ones that we chant every week. And there are several that were unknown to me. There's a whole section on relatively modern Zen women teachers. And I'll start with a relatively modern woman teacher, Tenmyo Jorin, who was born in Japan in 1848 and died in 1927. And the custom for women nuns, Buddhist nuns, was that actually, in general, in that time, it was mainly the men that were getting educated and not the women. And even in the temples, there was not Zen teaching. There was lots of Zen sitting, but not teaching. And so women were only allowed to become priests in the black robe. They weren't allowed to be transmitted, be Dharma heirs, and become teachers in their own right. Tenmyo went into the monastery, all-women monastery, at age 10, at the Yorin-an monastery in Kyoto, and 25 years later, she was the abbess there. This was a temple that had been there since the 1500s, and she was the 12th abbess there. And in the next few years, she was able to work with a male Zen teacher, and he made her his Dharma heir. And by the turn of the century, she and a few other transmitted nuns were able to start the whole process of educating women nuns so that they had the same education and transmission tradition that the male monks had been having for centuries. This was her gift to Buddhism. She also revived the centuries-old ceremony of thanking Ananda. Ananda, you know, was one of Buddha's disciples. He was Buddha's cousin, I believe, but in the first Buddhist Sangha, and it was Ananda that persuaded the Buddha to let women join their first community. And so there's a ceremony that she revived that's done to this day. It was done at the Branching Streams, or was it the SCBA this year that it was done as well. So this was also Tenmyo's gift to Buddhism, keeping this practice alive for all of us. And then I want to talk about one of our familiar ancestors, Upalavana. who was in Buddha's first community of women disciples, along with his male disciples. She was born into the warrior class, well-to-do, and she had a lot of suitors that she wasn't so interested in pursuing. She had already developed an interest in practicing the way. And it's said that her father was also pretty relieved not to have to choose a particular suitor. He could just say, well, she's decided to go into the monastery. And so he was, it sounds like it was political. He didn't have to lose face one way or another. He just said, you know, these children these days, they're just going into the monastery. Even in her probation period, within the first few months she was there, her meditation was so deep that she achieved arhatship. And people were probably confused by whenever this happens, the earth shakes and flowers fall from the sky. And it was just this teenager, you know, who'd just been there a few months, sitting so intently that she was able to drop off body and mind so completely that she attained arhatship. She developed magical powers. She and Buddha performed magical powers for the community. This was due to her deep practice, her intent practice. She appreciated it was a forest tradition. The monks tended to sit alone in the forest and then gather together during the rainy season for practice periods, and then kind of spread out and then come back together. So she was very much a part of that. But it was during one of her solo times that one of her former suitors found her, and she was raped by him. The record says that he received his karmic due and was banished to the hell realm. It's unclear whether this occurred right after the crime or whether it was another lifetime, but the story says that he could not escape his karma. And her intent practice was the basis of her healing, and that she's looked on as a refuge, as a model for people in search of any kind of healing, to look at the example of Upalavana. This is when there's precepts. We have our 16 precepts that we study, that we'll be chanting Monday night at the full moon ceremony. But monks in the monastery and nuns in the monastery have monastic precepts, a couple of hundred of them, that need to be followed. And it was because of the rape of Upalavana that many more precepts on the women's side were added, and it was mainly for safety reasons, but it actually kind of confined women's practice to monasteries, or at least never practicing alone, never being alone. So in one sense, it emerged, maybe a more constricted practice. Like I say, I'm just trying to find words, but there are more precepts that women monastics follow than the male monastics, even to this day. Upalavana returned to the nuns' sangha all the rest of her life in complete control of light, air, color, and form. She stayed in her human skin and showed only joy. So maybe we can have a few comments over the next few minutes. Any ideas that may have come up? Tim.
Okay, so using the example of hearing about Upalavana and how she gained magical powers through basically really intense sitting, it's kind of making me wonder part of this sort of underlines the whole Buddhist faith, but how fictionalized are some of these biographies?
Yeah.
Because magic isn't really documented anywhere else except in the holy text, and to my knowledge, the universe is way too ordered for flowers to rain from the sky. So how fictionalized are some of these?
Yeah. What this practice does for us, even here in 1217, is realize that this body and mind isn't what we think it is. Norman Fisher in the lecture says this practice shows us how much bigger this body and mind is than we ever thought it was, and also how much smaller it is. So that's an experience that I think we have time and again, that this really isn't what we think it is, and we want to just sit with that. And I believe some of the ornamented stories that we have inherited from our ancestors was how to describe this experience that we know isn't what we think it is. So I think that's why it's done. It's even when we listen to the story, we're able to sort of step out of the normal time and space constraints that we've come to agree on so rationally as you've pointed out. So I think that's why we see so many of these fantastic stories. Thank you. Any other thoughts come up about this Sesshin practice and the practice of turning the light inward and having this intimate dialogue with the hungry ghost of our self and our culture? Kathy?
I really enjoyed Norman's use of the word rupture. And I think it's unusual in this culture that we would choose to engage in something which pretty much is guaranteed that that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
We usually, myself included, try to offer comfort and, the helicopter. It's really popular now to do these trips with the helicopter.
Uh-huh. glamping.
I went and did a glamping thing. It was really amazing and really fun to have the sheets and everything. But it's not the same. Mm-hmm. And that experience of putting yourself in a position where you allow yourself to be ruptured, I think is one of the real gifts of sashimi.
Yeah.
And because it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, how many... Now, some people, their lives are just super hard, and every day is rupture. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And for many of us, that's not really so.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's this way that we can go deep, go beneath the chattering mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the biggest part of that, is to really take that one on and find out what else is possible for our minds and bodies and hearts to do when we're not being consumed by, curated by. You know, have our lives curated by this little voice.
Mm-hmm.
A, like you just said, there's a whole other realm. And, you know, I've never had flowers fall from the sky, but there certainly have been times of experiencing, like you said, how much it's beyond anything that we can ever really know when we just keep ourselves locked into our sort of familiar, everyday, safe, comfortable, habitual way of conducting ourselves.
Yeah. Yes.
So I appreciate you bringing it forward in our community. You know, it is an unusual thing to do, and it's a real kind of rare opportunity to have a temple like this that can support sashimi practice.
Yeah. John Kabat-Zinn called it full catastrophe living.
From Zorro.
And it's like that line, Dogen's line of, you know, practice as if your hair were on fire.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Is that working?
Thank you. Thank you all. May the merit of our sitting tonight be directed towards opening our hearts, opening our bodies and minds to the full catastrophe of suffering all around us, and may it contribute to the liberation from this suffering. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's rays unsurpassable. I vow to become it.